Mark Carney Exposed by Elias Trent. An adult brain audiobook production read to you by Barclay Cavill. Glossary of terms. ESG, Environmental, Social, and Governance. A corporate scoring framework that measures a company's environmental sustainability, social responsibility, and internal governance practices. ESG is increasingly used to direct investment capital and influence corporate behavior, often criticized for being subjective, non-transparent, and politicized. CBDC, Central Bank Digital Currency. A state-backed digital version of a national currency issued by a central bank, promoted as a secure, traceable, and programmable form of money, but widely criticized for enabling government surveillance, spending controls, and elimination of financial privacy. WEF, World Economic Forum. An international NGO headquartered in Switzerland, best known for its annual Davos summit. The WEF promotes global public-private cooperation and popularized terms like the Great Reset and stakeholder capitalism. Frequently criticized for being an unelected influence hub of billionaires, bureaucrats, and technocrats. Stakeholder capitalism. An economic model where corporations are accountable not just to shareholders but to a broader range of stakeholders, including governments, NGOs, and civil society. Framed as a more socially conscious than shareholder capitalism, but criticized for undermining property rights and democratic accountability. Net zero transition. A global economic initiative aimed at reducing carbon emissions to net zero by 2050. Involves massive shifts in energy, finance, infrastructure, and agriculture, promoted by Carney as the greatest commercial opportunity of our time. Carbon credits. Tradable certificates representing permission to emit a certain amount of carbon dioxide. Central to climate finance schemes, but heavily criticized for enabling greenwashing, speculation, and elite profit under the guise of environmentalism. Green bonds. Debt instruments used to fund environmentally friendly projects. Considered part of the broader ESG investing strategy, but questions remain about transparency, efficacy, and actual environmental impact. Technocracy. A system of governance where decision-making is led by technical experts, bureaucrats, and economists rather than elected representatives, promoted as efficient and evidence-based, but often seen as elitist, anti-democratic, and detached from public consent. The Great Reset. A post-COVID economic agenda launched by the WEF in 2020 calls for rebuilding better through stakeholder capitalism, ESG, digital identity, and sustainable finance. Described by critics as a cover for technocratic overreach and economic centralization. Privy Council. King's Privy Council for Canada. A formal advisory body to the Canadian monarch, which in practice serves as a discretionary appointment list for high-level government advisors, largely ceremonial today but used to grant legal power and confidentiality to elite insiders, Carney among them. Transition finance. Investments made to help companies shift from high-carbon to low-carbon operations. A core pillar of ESG and Carney's Brookfield portfolio, though often vague in scope and criticized for being little more than branding. Climate action and finance. UN Special Envoy role. Carney's UN appointment to mobilize private capital toward climate goals. The position lacks direct accountability and operates as a platform to influence governments, central banks, and corporations in alignment with global ESG targets. Digital identity. A digital representation of a person's verified attributes used to access services online and offline, frequently discussed in tandem with CBDCs and ESG to enable programmable rights, access, and permissions. Introduction. why Mark Carney matters. Mark Carney matters because he is the embodiment of the modern technocrat, unelected, unaccountable, and yet immensely powerful. To understand Carney is to understand how financial policy, global governance, and ideological rebranding converge into a new architecture of control. He is not just a banker. He is not just a bureaucrat. He is a front-facing symbol of a deeper globalist infrastructure that has quietly replaced democratic will with corporate consensus. His resume tells part of the story. Governor of the Bank of Canada, Governor of the Bank of England, Chair of the Financial Stability Board, Vice Chair and Head of ESG and Transition Investing at Brookfield Asset Management, and now presumptive Prime Ministerial Candidate for the Liberal Party of Canada. These roles are not the result of electoral approval, but selection by and for an inner circle of elites who control the flow of capital, the shape of climate policy, and the future of monetary sovereignty. Carney's power is not confined to any one office. He is a node in a transnational network, a global finance priesthood that answers not to citizens but to stakeholders, shareholders, and unelected panels. This is why he matters. Because he is not simply implementing policy, he is implementing ideology under the guise of inevitability. Net zero is not a debate. ESG is not a choice. Digital currencies are not voted on. They are managed into existence, and Carney is among the chief managers. He speaks the language of the reasonable man, of transition, resilience, and sustainability. But behind the euphemisms are policies that tighten the grip of banks over citizens, that elevate supranational institutions over national sovereignty, and that punish dissent through financial deplatforming and regulatory strangulation. When he warns of climate risk, what he really means is risk to the current financial architecture, from any deviation from the plan. Mark Carney does not sell policy, he sells inevitability. That's his greatest weapon. He packages technocracy as common sense and wraps globalism in the flag of environmental virtue. When a man this powerful goes largely unchallenged, when no opposition party questions his proximity to the World Economic Forum or his role in ESG-driven corporate monopolies, he becomes more than a public figure. He becomes a system unto himself. Understanding Carney, then, is not optional. If Canadians wish to reclaim any semblance of democratic choice, of national direction, they must unmask those who lead by stealth and speak in the coded language of progress. Mark Carney is not just Canada's problem. He is the face of a broader global convergence between finance, governance, and ideology. He matters not for who he is, but for what he represents. There is no such thing as neutrality in finance or governance. The myth that technocrats like Mark Carney operate in an impartial, a political vacuum is one of the most dangerous illusions of our time. It is sold to the public through sterile language. Stability, risk management, transition frameworks, macroeconomic tools. It conceals what is really happening. Ideological engineering via the balance sheet. When Mark Carney speaks about inflation, climate change, or digital currencies, he is not offering neutral analysis. He is offering a worldview. A worldview in which democratic deliberation is subordinate to financial consensus, in which sovereign policy takes a backseat to global benchmarks, in which morality itself is measured in ESG scores and carbon credits. Finance is the new morality play, and Carney, its soft-spoken high priest. The myth of neutrality persists because institutions want it to. Central banks claim independence while shaping national destinies. Global finance firms push green investing while holding stakes in mining conglomerates, weapons manufacturers, and data surveillance firms. Carney himself was vice chair at Brookfield, overseeing billions in energy assets while simultaneously advocating for a net zero transition, one he helped finance, regulate, and promote. Neutral? No. Strategic. The myth is effective because it disguises power. It suggests that policy is data-driven, not politically motivated. But there is always a choice in finance: what to subsidize, what to restrict, what to inflate, and what to let die. The printing of money is not neutral. It benefits some and burdens others. The introduction of carbon markets is not neutral. It shifts power from industry to bureaucracy. Central bank digital currencies are not neutral. They centralize surveillance and transaction control under the pretense of efficiency. And so we return to the core danger of Carney's model, the pretense that technocracy is apolitical. In reality, it is deeply ideological, committed to stakeholder capitalism, elite consensus, and supranational governance. It undermines accountability while claiming moral high ground. It rewards conformity and punishes deviation. By cloaking power in the language of science, economics, or climate urgency, Carney and his allies remove issues from the political arena and place them into managed frameworks where no vote can reverse them, no referendum can challenge them, and no citizen can meaningfully opt out. That's the myth. That's the game. And until we expose it, the system will continue to move, not toward democracy or prosperity, but toward a managed decline dressed in the language of inevitable progress. Technocracy is the new oligarchy, unaccountable, unelected, and masked in the language of expertise. Nowhere is this more evident than in the rise of ESG, environmental, social, and governance, frameworks, a soft power mechanism dressed as a moral compass but functioning as a corporate straitjacket, and Mark Carney, former central banker turned ESG evangelist, is its most articulate apostle. At first glance, ESG looks benign, even noble. Who wouldn't want cleaner air, better labor standards, and ethical boardrooms? But beneath the surface, ESG is a Trojan horse. It doesn't serve democracy. It sidesteps it. ESG metrics are not shaped by public vote or parliamentary debate. They are crafted by unelected advisory bodies, global consultancies, and asset managers with trillions under management. The public has no say. Yet these metrics now influence everything from pension funds to municipal investments. In effect, your economic future is being shaped not by your values, but by theirs. Carney's transition from the Bank of England to Brookfield Asset Management, and from there to the UN and climate finance leadership, tells the story. He didn't retire into obscurity. He pivoted into global governance, leveraged his credibility to push ESG as the guiding rubric for future investment. At Brookfield, he oversaw billions in green transition portfolios, while also holding major stakes in traditional infrastructure and fossil fuels. This is not ethical investing. It's financial colonialism cloaked in green. ESG also rewards conformity. Corporations that toe the line on climate, equity, or whatever the current value metric is, get access to cheaper credit, favorable media, and regulatory advantages. Those that don't are starved of capital or driven out of the market entirely. This isn't capitalism. It's behavioral engineering via financial leverage. It's not about creating value. It's about enforcing values. Globalized, bureaucratized, and weaponized against dissent. Technocracy and ESG together are the death knell of democratic accountability. Elected officials are increasingly irrelevant in the face of ratings agencies, central banks, and investment cartels. They don't legislate your future, they interpret mandates handed down by financial intermediaries. It's no wonder citizens feel powerless. Their vote can't compete with BlackRock's balance sheet or the IMF's conditionalities. And this is by design. Carney has openly advocated for a new financial system where climate targets, inclusion goals, and global standards are hardwired into the economy. But who writes the code? Who audits the algorithm? Not you, not me, not anyone who can be removed from office. That's the fatal flaw of technocracy. It believes governance without consent is a virtue. That if only the right minds are in charge, the messy business of democracy can be replaced with spreadsheets and compliance departments. But democracy is not a bug. It is the last firewall against totalizing control. ESG, in its current form, is not an expression of ethics. It is the erasure of accountability behind the facade of righteousness. And until we claim the economic levers from the technocrats who wield them, our future will not be governed. it will be programmed. Chapter 1. Prairie Grooming. Mark Carney's story begins far from the marble halls of central banks and global summits. He was born on March 16, 1965, in Fort Smith, Northwest Territories, a remote Canadian town nestled in the subarctic, where the northern lights hang low and winters are long. The son of a school principal and a teacher, Carney grew up in a household shaped by civic duty, education, and a strong sense of public responsibility. It was a setting that prized order, discipline, and achievement, but also it distanced him, both geographically and psychologically, from the populist pulse of Canada's cities. Fort Smith is not the kind of place that grooms technocrats. It's rugged, isolated, and intimately aware of nature's unforgiving extremes. Yet, it also sits at a crossroads between Indigenous territory, federal administration, and frontier pragmatism. These contrasts between central authority and local reality, theory and lived experience, would follow Carney throughout his career, though he'd rarely acknowledge them. The backdrop of his birth is important. Born just as Pierre Trudeau was rising to political power and recasting Canada as a centralized, multicultural state, Carney's early years unfolded in a country undergoing transformation, politically, economically, and socially. The Quiet Revolution in Quebec, the rise of federal power, and the emergence of technocratic liberalism would become the ideological terrain on which he built his identity. Though Fort Smith is distant from the boardrooms of Toronto or the think tanks of London, Carney never forgot his origins, or at least he never stopped invoking them. In interviews, he has spoken of growing up with a strong sense of fairness, attributing it to his small-town upbringing. But whether that fairness was shaped by his environment or by the ambitions of a family committed to an academic and social excellence is less clear. What is clear is this. From the start, Carney was not content to stay local. He was destined to leave Fort Smith behind, not in memory, but in practice. His birth in the Canadian North serves today as a kind of mythic origin story, a populist flourish used to soften the sharper edges of his elite career. But it is just that, a story. The real Carney is not a product of Fort Smith. He is a creation of global finance, Ivy League institutions, and transnational governance. His life in the Northwest Territories was not the soil from which his ideas grew. It was the point of departure. Mark Carney's educational path reads like a blueprint for technocratic ascent. After leaving the small-town confines of Fort Smith and graduating high school in Edmonton, he entered the Ivy League world of Harvard University, where his credentials would be stamped with elite approval. There, Carney studied economics and graduated in 1988 with a bachelor's degree that reflected more than just academic achievement. It marked his entry into a transnational class of thinkers and policymakers who would soon reshape the post-Cold War global order. At Harvard, Carney absorbed the prevailing neoliberal orthodoxy of the 1980s. This was the era of Reagan and Thatcher, of deregulation, globalization, and market worship disguised as freedom. The Department of Economics at Harvard was a training ground for future central bankers, IMF officials, and investment strategists, individuals groomed not to question the system but to manage it more efficiently. In this environment, Carney learned that markets were not to be restrained by national sovereignty, but rather optimized by data, algorithms, and informed policy choices. Democracy was an afterthought. Efficiency was king. He didn't stop there. Carney secured a Rhodes Scholarship to Oxford University, where he earned a master's degree and later a doctorate in economics at St. Peter's College. His time at Oxford further solidified his credentials, not merely in economic theory, but in the unspoken codes of the global elite. Oxford was not just about scholarship, it was about network, perception, polish. A man who could move seamlessly between Harvard's technocratic pragmatism and Oxford's philosophical gravitas would be well positioned to rule without ever having to run. His doctoral thesis, focused on the dynamics of exchange rates and inflation in emerging markets, offered an early glimpse into the world he would one day dominate, but it also revealed something deeper. Carney's instinct to abstract complex human economies into impersonal models. Like many of his generation, he was trained to see economies not as collections of people with moral agency, but as systems to be optimized and managed. What he lacked in ideological boldness, he made up for in institutional fluency. Carney emerged from Oxford as the perfect technocrat, intelligent without being visionary, adaptable without being unpredictable, and most of all, credible to the powerful. His education was not about cultivating originality, it was about earning trust from the global ruling class, and in that he succeeded brilliantly. Mark Carney's early life doesn't offer the tale of a visionary outsider rising from obscurity. It reflects something subtler and far more common in today's managerial elite, an early absorption of establishment values disguised as personal ambition. Born in Fort Smith, Northwest Territories, and raised in Edmonton, Alberta, Carney's upbringing was modest but hardly detached from professional ambition. His father was a high school principal turned academic, and his mother was a schoolteacher, both firmly embedded in the Canadian public education system. These were people who believed in the system and who raised a son to rise through it, not against it. There was no radical edge, no real rebellion, just a quiet, disciplined trajectory of achievement. From an early age, Carney stood out not because of grand dreams, but because of his adaptability and his knack for aligning with the expectations of authority figures. He wasn't a disruptor. He was a student of systems. He didn't challenge structures. He excelled within them. This became a pattern. He learned how to fit the mold better than most, and he was rewarded for it. There's no clear evidence of grand ideological conviction in Carney's youth. No early declarations about reshaping the world or fighting injustice. If anything, his ambitions were shaped by a refined version of Canadian pragmatism. Do well, keep your head down, and rise. The son of two educators, he adopted the value of performance, of doing what was expected and doing it better than anyone else. But here's the rub. Those values, when fused with elite education, produced something more than just a high achiever. They produced a man capable of operating in the upper echelons of finance and politics without ever appearing political. His early ambition was not to change the world, but to navigate it, to master its levers and institutions. And by mastering them, he would eventually help redefine them, quietly, efficiently, and always under the banner of neutrality. Carney's values were not radical. They were bureaucratic excellence, elite competence, and managerial confidence. But in today's global order, that's more than enough to shape nations. Chapter 2. Goldman Sachs, Making a Globalist. If Mark Carney's academic journey provided the credentials, his 13-year tenure at Goldman Sachs forged the worldview. Goldman was more than just a training ground. It was a baptism into the highest tier of global finance, a place where loyalty to the firm blurred into loyalty to a transnational elite. This was where Carney became fluent in the language of capital, not as an abstract force, but as a mechanism that runs the world. At Goldman, Carney wasn't pushing paper. He was deep in the engine room, working in sovereign risk and managing debt portfolios for nations, not just corporations. His resume includes time in London, New York, Tokyo, and Toronto, strategically rotating through the major financial capitals of the globe. This wasn't just about learning markets. It was about learning how to think beyond borders. National economies became spreadsheets. Governments became clients. Everything could be priced, hedged, and if necessary, leveraged. He didn't just observe the global order from the outside. He learned to manage its machinery from within. And crucially, Goldman taught him the ultimate lesson of modern finance. Power is not held by those who make laws, but by those who shape liquidity. This was Carney's initiation into the quiet corridors of influence where supranational organizations, multinational banks, and elite think tanks set the agenda far removed from democratic scrutiny. Goldman Sachs was infamous even then for its alumni network, a pipeline that feeds directly into central banks, treasuries, and supranational institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. Carney's entry into that ecosystem wasn't accidental. He was the perfect fit, articulate, competent, ideologically malleable. He wasn't radical, but he was ambitious, not confrontational, but calculating. In the world of high finance, that made him dangerous. By the time he left Goldman in 2003, Carney had been shaped into something more than a banker. He had absorbed a creed that markets must be managed, that risk must be socialized, and that governance should be guided by technocrats rather than voters. Goldman taught him not just how money moves, but how power conceals itself within the movement of money. It is no coincidence that so many public servants today pass through Goldman's halls. It is not a bank. It is a proving ground for the globalist class. Carney emerged from it as a man who could operate as a central banker, a climate czar, or a policy whisperer. He left Goldman with a Rolodex of sovereign leaders and a worldview that sees democracy as inefficient and public consent as an afterthought. This was the crucible. This is where the mask of Canadian modesty fused with the machinery of international control. And it's where Mark Carney, the globalist technocrat, was born. To understand the reach of Mark Carney, one must first understand the revolving door, Goldman Sachs' signature contribution to modern governance. It's a model of seamless integration between private finance and public money, where former investment bankers become central bank governors, treasury secretaries, and climate envoys without ever changing loyalties. Goldman Sachs doesn't just produce financiers, it manufactures influence, and Carney is a near-perfect embodiment of this model. The so-called Alumni Club of Goldman Sachs is not some symbolic designation. It is an operational network, tightly wound, discreet, and extraordinarily effective. Its members pass from one role to another with uncanny ease, occupying the most sensitive and powerful positions in the financial and political architecture of the modern world. And while their job titles may change, CEO, central banker, climate envoy, or finance minister, their ideological commitments and class alliances remain disturbingly consistent. When Carney left Goldman in 2003, he didn't leave the club. He simply took on a new role in a new wing of the same establishment. He stepped into the Canadian Department of Finance, later moving on to the Bank of Canada and eventually the Bank of England. At each stop, he implemented policies that aligned more with market logic than democratic accountability. Inflation targeting, austerity-friendly rate regimes, and bailouts disguised as stability, all executed with the quiet assurance of someone who knew he would never be held to account by the voting public. And it's not just Carney. The Goldman pipeline runs deep. Consider Mario Draghi, former Goldman executive turned European Central Bank president, or Robert Rubin, Goldman co-chairman turned U.S. Treasury secretary, or Hank Paulson, who did the same and handed out trillion-dollar bailouts during the 2008 crash to protect the very institutions he once ran. The same doors swing open for them all. Public office is simply the next boardroom. This revolving door doesn't just blur the lines between public and private. It erases them. When the same people rotate between roles, institutions become indistinguishable. Is the Bank of England a public body or a Goldman satellite office? Is the UN's climate finance initiative serving global interests or multinational capital? When Mark Carney becomes chair of Brookfield Asset Management, then the UN climate envoy, and now a potential prime ministerial candidate, does he represent the people or his peers in the alumni club? Carney's trajectory is not exceptional. It is prototypical. He is what Goldman alumni are trained to become, highly literate in financial complexity, ideologically loyal to market technocracy, and entirely detached from the consequences of their decisions. The revolving door works because those who pass through it understand their real constituency is not voters or citizens, it is capital itself. And here lies the central danger. Democratic institutions, already fragile, are being gradually replaced by transnational networks of unelected elites. The Goldman Alumni Club is not just a symptom of this trend, it is its architect. Through this revolving door, global policy is engineered not in parliaments, but in boardrooms. And Mark Carney walks through it smiling, untouched, unaccountable, and ever upward. The beginning of a career of quiet consolidation. Mark Carney's ascent into the halls of power was never marked by bombast or radical declarations. It was instead defined by precision, discipline, and remarkable ability to operate within the machinery of existing institutions while subtly tightening their alignment with a technocratic, finance-first worldview. This was not a man who sought change from the outside. Carney's genius lay in infiltrating the system from within and then recalibrating it with surgical efficiency. His was a career of quiet consolidation, consolidating power, influence, and institutional trust under the guise of competent stewardship. From his early days at the Department of Finance in Canada, Carney made it clear that his strengths lay in policy fluency and bureaucratic navigation. He didn't bring populist rhetoric or big promises. He brought models, numbers, and a Harvard-educated fluency in elite code switching. While most Canadians couldn't have picked him out of a lineup, Bay Street and Ottawa insiders recognized in him a valuable asset, a man who could make the interests of finance appear as public goods. His rapid rise to the governorship of the Bank of Canada in 2008 was no accident. Behind the scenes, Carney had already begun crafting a profile that bridged credibility with discretion. He didn't court headlines. He secured confidence. The financial crisis gave him the perfect backdrop. Canada emerged from the 2008 meltdown relatively unscathed, and Carney was positioned as the prudent guardian of Canadian economic stability. What few noticed was the ideological underpinning of that stability. Policies that prioritized asset inflation, capital consolidation, and monetary insulation of the banking elite. This phase of his career wasn't about front-facing influence, it was about building institutional power. Carney deepened the authority of central banking not as a democratic safeguard, but as an autonomous technocracy, beyond political reach and shielded from public pressure. At the Bank of Canada and later at the Bank of England, he nurtured a new orthodoxy. One in which monetary policy served as a political tool masquerading as neutral science. His consolidation of credibility gave cover to an expansion of influence, and that influence was directed not toward rebalancing the system, but reinforcing its most extractive structures. At each level of Carney's ascent, the same pattern emerged. Avoid scrutiny, deepen control. He was the architect of forward guidance. A term that sounds benign, but in practice meant long-term guarantees to capital markets that the central bank would act in their favor. He institutionalized complex communication strategies that made central banking even more opaque to the public. And perhaps most significantly, he helped usher in the era of ESG, environmental, social, and governance-based investing. As a new frontier for capital, further tightening finance's grip on every sphere of public and private life. In retrospect, this was the period where the future of governance was quietly rewritten. Under Carney's leadership, central banks ceased to be merely monetary institutions. They became cultural authorities, climate advisors, and social arbiters. None of this was framed as revolution. It was presented as prudence. And therein lies Carney's greatest strength, the ability to radically reshape institutions under the polite cloak of moderation. His was not a populist rise. It was a coronation by committee, a career crafted not in the daylight of public discourse, but in the airless rooms of policy briefings, economic forums, and Davos salons. It is here, away from voters, that Carney consolidated not only his power, but the very template of 21st century governance, post-democratic, market-led, and impeccably credentialed. The quiet consolidation continues, and Carney, ever the polished technocrat, remains the high priest of this new order. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.